Good morning. May it please the court. Lisa Wright representing Mr. Robert Hall. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. A new trial is required in this case because the record does not show that Mr. Hall waived counsel voluntarily. Rather, the record shows that his decision to go pro se was the result of what he saw as a Hobson's choice between unprepared counsel and no counsel. This court recognized in Cunningham that where a Feretta election appears grounded in dissatisfaction with counsel, the trial court must evaluate the defendant's objections to ensure that the self-representation election is voluntary. And Cunningham shows how a proper inquiry can ensure that a defendant is not facing the constitutional dilemma Mr. Hall confronted here. In Cunningham, the defendant was convinced his attorney was disloyal. The court inquired, got to the bottom of it, and it turned out that the defendant had been misreading a newspaper article. We've cited cases like Farrell, where, unlike Cunningham, the inquiry was inadequate and new trials were granted. The government simply says the inquiry was adequate and cites Cunningham. But here, unlike Cunningham, the court simply did not get to the bottom.
Well, it cites Brown.
Pardon?
It cites Brown.
This court's Brown. For the Feretta inquiry, but I don't know that Brown had made the sort of...
Well, Brown wasn't dealing with voluntariness.
Yes.
I understand that, but the government cites Gant and Brown.
Yeah, I think those...
Gant was dealing with the continuance, and Brown was dealing with the inquiry.
Well, I think the Feretta inquiry, a typical Feretta inquiry, just to make sure the person is understanding everything, is different than when someone has raised a specific concern. That's what the court said in Cunningham. I mean, you have to dispel.
I see the defendant raised four concerns. One, these are just my notes, that there, as far as he knew, there were no witnesses or evidence for the defense, that the attorney had not been over to Maryland where the boxes that the government had turned over were stored, that they'd met only 2 hours in a month, and that the government had not turned over exculpatory evidence, especially some videotapes.
Well, I think that he was complaining that Mr. McDaniel had not requested copies of them because I think they were things that he believed to be in Maryland, and it was not just the video. The cash receipt books, I think, were even more.
So what I just described as four is that a complaint that the defense attorney had not requested.
Yes, and I have those same four. He's complaining that Mr. McDaniel had not gotten these particular materials. In other words, he's complaining he hasn't gone and looked at the stuff at all, but he said, I've identified these things I know to be there, and he hasn't even asked for copies of those or gone and, you know, you're not allowed to copy them. You have to go and ask for copies or submit a Brady request for it or something.
All right, so the district court responded to the fourth concern by saying that, just because the defendant thinks the government ought to turn something over doesn't mean the government has any obligation to turn the material over.
Right.
The attorney explained to the judge about the 2 hours a month.
Well, he basically admitted it.
Yeah, he said both his schedule and the defendant's schedule had interfered with their original plan. And the judge said, well, there may not be any witnesses.
Yeah, I mean, he just said, perhaps there are no witnesses, I don't know. And under Farrell, that's exactly the kind of thing that your district court is supposed to ask. Have you contacted witnesses?
Farrell quotes Von Moltke, mm-hmm. saying that the district court has to inquire. So your point is, just so I'm clear, is that the ex parte conversation between the attorney and the judge, Mr. McDaniel, should have gone over these four things, sort of in hoc verba.
Should have evaluated the preparation. I mean, yes, to attempt to assure Mr. Hall that he was prepared, and if, or at least assure the district court that there is no reason to think he's not. And I think it's very similar to Farrell in that the sort of a bleakness of the questions, which was just, could you respond? And the brevity of the responses, which was just, I think we have differ about the degree of preparation, wasn't enough to get to the truth of the allegations, which is what is really required. And on the exculpatory—
Can I ask about Farrell? Farrell is a D.C. Court of Appeals. It's not our opinion,
that's
right?
That's correct.
And it's citing a four-justice opinion in Von Moltke, which the Supreme Court has never adopted. Mm-hmm. Isn't that right?
Well, for the principle that, I mean, I suppose that's true, but the—
I mean, the extensiveness of the inquiry suggested in Von Moltke is definitely not. And we've said ourselves in, I don't remember which case, that the court had not adopted that and that a shorter inquiry is sufficient, right?
Right. But I can't imagine, though, the court wouldn't think that the inquiry has to be adequate in order to dispel this dilemma for the defendant. You know, that's what happened in Cunningham. It's true there aren't a lot of cases in this court where we've fleshed out what the scope of the inquiry is, but it has to be good enough to dispel this concern or conviction, really. I mean,
the district court seemed persuaded that what the problem here was not that the defense counsel wasn't prepared, but that the defendant didn't want to go to trial, and that this was somebody who he had seen in operation. That there, in the beginning, it sounded like there was a problem with respect to turning over documents by the government, and it was made clear that that wasn't a problem, and in the end, the defendant said it wasn't.
Right.
When you actually get to the trial, the defendant really has no defense. Isn't that right?
I disagree. He testified for 2 days.
He did testify for 2 days.
And
he told the investors that he was investing in property. Right, and the money would come from the property. But in fact, he admitted that they hadn't bought any property, and that the money was coming from the other investors.
Right. I mean,
that's a Ponzi scheme. I don't understand. True, he said I didn't intend to defraud, but that's a statement. All the evidence is that he did.
Well, I think a lot of this has to do. Some of it is subtle because, first of all, I'll get to that, but I don't think necessarily what happened at trial really impacts whether he voluntarily waived counsel. But
let's first get.
Yeah.
I agree. That's a difficult question about how much it impacts that.
Some of this is subtle about what Your Honor is saying about the buying of the property. I mean,
it's correct that over the whole period, no property was bought, right?
Right. But there were attempts. I mean, I think the government says something about no attempt was made whatsoever. I think there was evidence that, letters were sent out to every property owner.
But he told people that he had property.
Well, that's what I was going to say. I mean, I think there is, if you read the prospectus, there is sort of a sense that there's almost like a tense issue here. Because what the prospectus is saying is, here's the plan. We do this, we do that, we do this, we do that.
He sent a letter saying he had $21 million pool.
That is exactly what I'm talking about. Because if you read the prospectus, and I wish I'd had space in my reply brief to say this, that $21 million check he makes very clear in the prospectus is a potential buyer pool. It's a demand, it's a market that he can tap into. He's saying there are $21 million worth of people out there who would buy these properties, even though it might seem counterintuitive that someone who would want to live in a $70,000 condo in a bad neighborhood could afford a $70,000 condo. They actually can, and therefore they would want to do so, and there's $21 million.
In the entire time he was there, he didn't buy a single piece of property, and not any of the money that he paid back came out of anything other than other people's investments.
His argument was he was putting the money into the business. These were soft costs, et cetera.
I understand his argument. It seems
frivolous. Like it does cast doubt, though, on his intent and on whether there was truly a scheme. And going back to the...
I don't understand how it casts doubt. The definition of a Ponzi scheme is paying early investors with later investors' money.
Not every time someone uses later money, I mean, a corporation or whatever might use money to pay someone off. I mean, that's, you can refinance a debt or whatever. That doesn't make it a Ponzi scheme. There's a lot more factors to it.
There's no papers, nothing in any of the papers suggests that's the way people are going to be getting their money, is it? All the papers that he provided to people and all their testimony is that the money was going to come from the property.
Right. Well, what I'm saying about the prospectus, though, is it's written in a tense. It's written like, here's the plan. We do this, then we do that, then we do this, then we do that. The government is interpreting, and the jury could have interpreted, as we are doing it. But it's really presented in like, this is the plan. This is what I plan to do. And I don't have a $21 million. That's why I'm going to you. And I want to do this, and that's my plan. I'm going to do this, do that. And it's written in this tense that does, it's ambiguous. I mean, whether the person he's saying, I've already done this, or this is what I want to do, and that's why I want you to give me money. So that's my position on that. But the exculpatory, the business about the discovery, I think there were two problems with the court's, Your Honor was mentioning that the court thought basically he was trying to delay trial and that this was some kind of strategy dispute, and that this was, the other thing was the discovery dispute. And both of those were actually factually incorrect, because it was really an obvious misunderstanding of the defendant's complaints, because he said flat out it's not a strategy dispute. And he also said, I don't have any problem with discovery. I think the problem was the district court heard, you know, I don't have documents. And the district court sort of jumped to the conclusion, as defendants often think, that they're entitled to stuff they're not entitled to. And in fact, the stuff he was talking about was stuff sitting out in Columbia, totally available to his lawyer, and his lawyer had just not bothered to go look at it. So that was a misunderstanding. He tells Mr. Hall, you're operating on a false premise. So he even says, I don't know what you're talking about with this, you know, what they should know that they don't know and you know.
Has he suggested what the nature of the evidence that would have helped him or what witness would have helped him?
Pardon?
Has he suggested what kind of evidence would have helped him or what witness would have helped him?
I mean, in this colloquy?
Either then or now, in terms of your brief. I mean, what is it that, in what way was the defense counsel unprepared?
Well, he was unfamiliar with the facts of the case. That was the central problem. He had failed to investigate.
That's not what he says. I mean, he said that he had had an opportunity to see everything, that he was prepared.
No, he'd seen everything the government gave him. He did physically copies of, basically, the government exhibits.
There are facts of the case, and there are relevant facts of the case. What relevant facts?
The government seized all those documents because that was how the business ran.
I got it, but I'm asking what evidence, what aspect of that would have been relevant to his case?
Well, you know, he ended up representing himself, and he did know the facts, so I don't know what, you know, Mr. McDaniel wouldn't have known or how he would have failed.
Can we rely on the motion that he filed for a continuance where he indicated why he needed the continuance?
Well, he gives some examples of what he tries to do is say, these are things that aren't my fault. You know, he lists some things that aren't his fault, he thinks, and the government comes back and says, well, actually, that is your fault because we gave you that stuff. But the bottom line is, he says in the continuance, I'm not prepared, and he never, ever recants from that. The district court thinks he's recanting or thinks that he's saying that he feels prepared, when all he ever said is that he had felt prepared before the meeting, and something happened, and the judge never asks him, why did you file this motion? You know, why did you say how can we square the fact that you now are saying you're prepared, which he never did say?
It seems from the judge's statements that what the judge thinks is that the client told him to file the motion, and due to file a lawyer, he filed it even though he thought he was actually prepared.
Look, he cannot make a representation as an officer of the court that he's not prepared when he is prepared.
Well, his statement about whether he's prepared is, I would say, when you talk about ambiguous, it's skating right on the edge of trying to do that without doing it. That is, he's trying to say, I'm not prepared, I'm prepared, but for the benefit of his client is saying he's not. That's what it sounds like, and that's what it sounds like the judge thought it sounded like. That he really wasn't saying he was unprepared, that his client wanted him to say that, and so he was saying it for the client.
Well, I don't think that's what a lawyer ethically does. I mean,
that's a different question. I haven't heard any argument here about ineffective assistance of counsel or unethical. I agree.
The judge has to assume that officer of the court is, you know, not.
Well, he's trying to walk that line, it seems like, and the judge isn't buying it.
But if the judge is so sure that there's not really a problem here, he's got to dispel it from Mr. Hall's mind, and the way to do that is to bring the facts to light. So then it'll be clear on the record that this was a meaningless complaint he had. But in fact, I mean, the record as it stands has an admission. I didn't think they were that ambiguous. He said, I'm not prepared to proceed with trial, and I can't represent that I'm adequately prepared to zealously defend Mr. Hall. That's pretty strong language. And if it's based on a strategy dispute, he shouldn't really be saying that, because his job is to present the strategy he thinks is most effective. And unless Mr. Hall persuaded him, I think, you know, it's a situation where they sit down on Saturday and finally, okay, there's been some hope in Mr. McDaniel's mind this was going to plead out. Uh-oh, it's not. Now we're talking about the facts, and it turns out there's a lot of things that need to be done. And it's not really about...
Let's be clear, though. The attorney tells the judge that as of Saturday, he was prepared.
Going in.
I know, but I mean, Saturday morning, he was prepared.
In his mind.
Then he met with the defendant.
Right.
Then something happened.
The
attorney files this motion where he doesn't say, based on the defendant's concerns, he says, given the volume of documentation and the volume of documentation provided even after January of 06, counsel is not prepared to proceed with trial.
That's right.
And at the hearing on January 30th, where does the judge indicate that he is persuaded this is not a concern?
He never really says, I find as a fact Mr. McDaniel's prepared. And there certainly was not enough information for him to make such a finding, because Mr. McDaniel didn't really say what he had done, other than I'm familiar with the government exhibits and some of the players.
But you're not challenging the, you expressly say you're not challenging the denial of the continuance.
Not as a ground to reverse,
well,
no, but I'm saying that.
Saying he wasn't prepared, or then why aren't you challenging the ground of continuance? You're saying the judge should have granted a continuance.
Well, I think I discussed that in the reply that, you know.
Well, I brought that up in terms of this was before the judge. The
right.
judge said, I'm denying the continuance. He said, now I'm turning to this other issue. After the defendant says he wants to proceed pro se.
Yeah, he first says, the closest he ever comes to saying McDaniel is prepared is when he says something and then, like, double negative, like, I don't find he hasn't done what an effective counsel would do, or something like that. He never even says, Mr. Hall, your lawyer is prepared, you've just heard what he said, you know, and nothing like that. And then he won't even let Mr. Hall speak to the continuance, or to explain the other things that Mr. McDaniel hasn't done besides the things he's admitted to. And so finally, he has to actually say, please may I go pro se, in order for him to even be able to speak. Then he speaks.
I mean, what's sort of odd about this case is the judge asks a lot of questions. And I was trying to think of a hypothetical. Suppose Mr. McDaniels was really named Edward Bennett Williams. Do you know who that is?
Yes.
Well, you know, I mean, my clerks didn't know who that was.
Probably.
But anyway, I mean, an esteemed criminal defense attorney. And he's sitting in the courtroom, and the judge says, Mr. Williams, will you come up here and represent Mr. Hall? And so Mr. Hall makes all these complaints, and the judge says to Mr. Williams, what's your response? And Mr. Williams says what Mr. McDaniel says. And it's sort of in that aura that the judge knows something about this attorney that's not in the record.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I'm just wondering what we do with it as an appellate judge. I mean, I don't know anything about Mr. McDaniels other than that he was sitting in the courtroom and the judge and Mr. Hall said he was an excellent attorney,
right.
but he just wasn't prepared.
That's right. And I think the problem with the hypothetical you're giving is it wouldn't, the point is there has to be defendant's state of mind has to be cleared up. If the defendant is under this impression, perhaps it is a misimpression, we don't know. But if he's under it, it's not enough for the court to say, well, I know he's prepared. The point is, Mr.
How is it ever going to get cleared up? The defendant in this case, what if the defendant's going to say, that's not good enough?
Well, at some point, I mean, it is good enough.
Well, so that is the question at some point. So here McDaniel says, Your Honor, I think we disagree about the level of preparation.
He doesn't say what it is.
Well, he says, I have been provided the bulk of the information from the government. I did review some of that with Mr. Hall. Mr. Hall came up and I came up with a schedule. It became an impossibility to keep the schedule, but during that time I became familiar with the information that had been presented by the government. Given my original conversations in light of the accusations, what his representations would be, I felt as if we were prepared to deal with the case in the fashion which we originally intended to defend it.
And if we were at midday on Saturday, that might be enough. But the problem is something happened after that that caused Mr. McDaniel to change his mind.
Nothing happened other than another meeting with the client.
Right, during which facts were discussed, and Mr. McDaniel came to a realization that there were things undone that he must have, in his mind, thought were necessary.
You said he came to this realization. I don't see any place where it says he came to that
realization. We know what he thought going into the meeting, and we know what happened after the meeting, so that his mind must have changed.
Yeah, it may have been that the client, as the judge said, told him that this is a party who wishes very much to have the trial go cannot have the trial go forward, who's basically wishing to do whatever is necessary in order for that to accomplish a delay of the trial. And I don't believe it's appropriate basis to grant the request. That's what the judge said, having seen client in front of him and the lawyer in front.
And clearly misunderstood what the client was saying, both misunderstanding what McDaniel's saying. He thinks McDaniel's claiming that it's a strategy dispute, which he's not. And he also thinks Mr. Hall is complaining the government hasn't given him discovery that he's that his, somehow his lawyer was supposed to get through a motion to compel or something.
Can you back up? I'm sorry. On the prospectus, you were.
Yes.
So I'm looking at this prospectus that says, to reiterate, we just went into a group of public housing facilities with a very realistic mortgaging structure system, walked out with a $21 million real estate development fund. We must now, of course, spend our $21 million wisely. Now, what's the tense issue here?
Well, I don't know if that's the tense. He's.
We've walked out with a $21 million real estate development fund, and we must now spend our $21 million wisely.
He's saying there's $21 million worth of buyers out there, and we are going to get them to buy our condominium.
I'm sorry, I'm not seeing that. Where does it say?
If you read the whole thing, it is quite clear, I think. He's saying there's this, the problem is, you know, poor people can't afford houses. Poor people get kicked out of their neighborhood by people who can afford houses. But guess what? You can buy a house with very little of your own money down because there's all these fabulous programs. And if you look at the statistics for the Rock Creek public housing area and you multiply it by the 300, he's very conservative, 300 people times $70,000 a piece, it comes up to $21 million. He calculates, it's very clear what he's doing. He's calculating the potential market for people to buy these condos if they then go and buy properties in bulk and and sell it to them. There'll be plenty of money for profits for him, plus these people will have a home that they want to live in their own neighborhood and it'll be improved property as opposed to, you know, a run-down apartment complex. So that was the plan. I think it's very clear, and it's actually, I mean, it's certainly not anything that wouldn't work in theory. And it's very clear what he's saying. So I think the question really is, you know, did he cleverly write this really always intending a Ponzi scheme, or was this a legitimate thing that didn't work out because, you know, the letters weren't answered and he didn't move fast enough and he didn't have enough capital and whatever other business mistake he might have made.
All right, let me stop you because you've gone double over your time. Judge Rogers, do you have questions on the other issues? Judge Garland, all right.
Thank you.
Ms. Kurt.
Good morning, Your Honors. Suzanne Kurt on behalf of the United States. I would like to begin by saying that the record indicates that the trial judge did not abuse his discretion when he found that the source of dispute was a strategic difference between appellant and his lawyer. That was the first decision that he made. That's clearly supported by the record. And secondly, that the reason for appellant's dissatisfaction with his counsel was not valid, but was merely an excuse to avoid going to trial and to delay trial for as long as he possibly could.
What do you do with the judge's statements where he repeatedly says, "I don't know whether there are any witnesses. I don't know." And that's one of the specific things the defendant raised. And then he says the court cannot know. There's this difficult sentence to parse about.
Yes. Your Honor, first of all, this court has never imposed a requirement that that trial judges should inquire into the attorney-client relationship and what the defense is, and that would probably be improper to probe thoroughly, but just because...
What's your authority for that?
Well, the court has not required trial judges to intrude themselves into the defense, the relationship between an appellant and
I'm
his client.
You. What is your authority for where the defendant has raised four concerns about the preparation of his attorney?
Well,
what is your authority that the district court may not inquire into that in determining the voluntariness of a waiver of counsel?
I'm not saying that the court should not inquire, but this court has required that, has not required that be extensive, but it merely be an inquiry, but it need be, it can be brief as long as it's
Brown
adequate.
For that.
Yes.
And Brown was not voluntariness.
Well, Your Honor, I'd like to talk about this to answer your specific.
No, but you started out by saying the record is clear.
Yes, and I.
All right, and I said, well, what do you do with these statements in the record where the judge says he doesn't know the very things that the defendant has objected to?
Well, the fact that there are no witnesses at that point in time in the courtroom present, or the fact that there weren't exhibits, if that were true, does not necessarily mean that counsel's unprepared.
Of course not.
And
but the question is, does the judge have to inquire of the attorney?
Well, the judge did inquire of the attorney.
About witnesses?
Well, he asked him, what do you have to say about your degree of preparation? Now, I'd like to back up a little bit, because Your Honor asked a question regarding what did Judge Kennedy, what did he know about this lawyer? And I think we need to view all of these things in context. And when Judge Kennedy appointed Mr. McDaniel in April, he told appellant that McDaniel had appeared in front of him before, and in one of the matters that he had appeared, it was a complex matter. So he was familiar with McDaniel's ability.
But my hypothetical, Mr. Williams says, you know, he's a great attorney, but he's got five other trials in Maryland. So he just hasn't been able to devote the time to this case. How would the judge ever know that if he didn't ask questions?
Well, I think we need to back up and go to what happened, what was the first thing that happened in this case. And Mr. McDaniel, an officer of the court, explained to Judge Kennedy that he and his client had met in the beginning of the case, and they had met throughout the case, and they had planned a specific defense based on a specific defense strategy. And he stated that he was prepared to defend the case.
And he filed this motion as an officer of the court.
Yes.
Which he says he is not prepared.
Well, it was a very bare bones motion, as I think.
In fairness, counsel, it's a clear sentence. I am not prepared.
And the following day, or the day
because of. Because he hadn't had time to review all these documents. And that's one of the complaints the defendant had, that he hadn't reviewed the documents.
And in court, respectfully, Your Honor, in court on the 30th, he illuminated that. And I think we need to look very carefully.
How did he illuminate it?
Well, I think we need to look very carefully at exactly what he said. He explains.
What page are you on?
I'm looking at pages 4 through 7, very specifically, of the January 30th transcript.
Okay.
And on page 4, he again explains that, and he's explaining the basis for his motion. And he does flesh it out more thoroughly. He said he had prepared a defense based on the appellant's representation and their agreement. So at that point, he states that he was prepared. Then he explains that after they looked at more documents, the documents that he was already familiar with, appellant said, "We are not ready." But Mr. McDaniel said that was not his position. Again, and then
at the top of 7, do you see that? The bottom of 6, top of 7.
Yes, ultimate. That is his ultimate position at the top.
I don't feel as if I am prepared to do what it is that Mr. Hall is now asking me to do.
Yes, he is not saying I'm not prepared to defend the case in the way I think it should be prepared. He's saying at that point in time, Mr. Hall, on Saturday evening, has decided that he wants this case defended in a different way. And I'm not prepared to do that right now, but I am prepared, you know, to defend that case as we had planned already through.
Right, but he never says to the judge what Mr. Hall has in mind is either frivolous, insubstantial, meritless. For all we know, Mr. Hall had a good idea. I mean, the attorney never tells the judge that what Mr. Hall is suggesting is not worth pursuing.
Well, case law clearly supports the fact that strategic decisions as to how to defend a case.
Well, we don't even know if this is a strategic decision.
Well, appellant, when he was given the opportunity to then state what his disagreements were, does not state any strategic differences that they had. So I think we have to take counsel at his word that, you know, I was prepared to defend this case in the way that we had always agreed. I have received everything that I need from the government to defend this case, and I was ready to go forward. I think it's, as Judge Garland noted, I think it's quite clear that defense counsel is saying to the court, my client wants me to do something different now. I'm ready to defend the case in the way that we planned.
Well, let me step back with you in a moment. What interest does the government have in not having the district court clear up the defendant's concerns before the trial begins? I mean, the Feretta matter has always been troubling to district courts. And in many of the records, you see the district court goes on at length because of concerns about proceeding with pro se defendants.
And we don't have an interest in not having that cleared up.
Right. So why shouldn't the court hold that the judge must at least address the matters that the defendant has raised as grounds for his concern that his attorney is not prepared?
Well,
it's an appointed attorney.
I think that the judge did do that in this case. I think we have to remember that, you know, Judge Kennedy had this case for over a year.
He never asked the defense attorney, do you have any witnesses or evidence that you're going to put on?
Granted, he didn't, but I think this was, he, again.
Suppose the attorney said, I don't know, Your Honor, because I haven't had a chance to review all these documents, as I mentioned in the motion for continuance.
But I think, Your Honor, I think the court has to realize that Judge Kennedy is sitting there, and he's listening to Mr. McDaniel, he's listening to appellant. These people have been before him on at least four occasions. He knows the history of the case. He knows the history of appellants having a proclivity to want to, you know, represent himself on a couple of occasions.
Well, I heard you say that, but on the other hand, you know, this man had an attorney, had retained counsel, then got a continuance so he could see if he could raise the money to continue to pay private counsel.
But McDaniel, interestingly,
I mean, that's separate from the judge making a decision, look, you've had plenty of time, we're going ahead.
But interestingly, McDaniel did say to the court that even after he was appointed, appellant expressed an interest in wanting to represent himself, and he discussed that, and McDaniel discouraged him from doing that. But in any event, so Judge Kennedy has a real familiarity with this party. He's listened, and he's stood there, and he's listened to exactly what defendant has said about his complaints. Then he listens to McDaniel, and then he makes a credibility determination, essentially.
But he says, I don't know. I don't know on the very matters that the defendant has raised. And that's what I'm trying to understand. Does the judge have any obligation to get answers to those questions where he says he doesn't know?
This court has never required specific.
I know, but I want to understand what the law is here. We have the Cunningham case where the district court went at great length. All right, we have that precedent on the books.
Well, what the defendant was complaining about here is that his attorney was not prepared. The attorney addressed that and said, "I am familiar with the government's. I am familiar with the government's material. I have prepared a defense."
Didn't he filed a motion that said he wasn't prepared because he hadn't had time to review the documents? Extraordinary situation?
As the court undoubtedly knows, that was a very bare-bones motion, and then I think we have to take that in context with what
but why would an officer of the court file a motion with the district court, asking the district court to adjust its docket, a very serious matter, on the grounds that defense counsel is saying, I am not prepared because I haven't had a chance to review the documents?
Because his client was obviously urging him to.
But he didn't say that in the motion, and he didn't say that before the district court.
Well, could he have said that? Would it have not have been an ethical breach for him to say that my client is pressing me to say this even though I am prepared? I mean, could he disclose that?
Did he say in the ex parte that was not allowed?
Probably. He could have explained it at more at length, and he could have said the things that Your Honor has suggested. But ethically, he could have explained it in a different fashion, I think. But I think it's clear here as to what the court was saying is that he was raising this because his client and he had a major disagreement on Saturday, and his client was urging him to do this and was putting McDaniel in undoubtedly a very awkward situation where he felt...
He didn't actually say that, though.
Well, if you go...
He said, I don't feel as if I am prepared to do what it is that Mr. Hall is now asking me to do.
Right.
That's not saying that Mr. Hall has asked him to do anything that is improper or that would be frivolous or useless, or that I disagree with Mr. Hall about pursuing this.
But, Your Honor, if you look at that bottom of page 6 and top of page 7 in context, we know that Mr. McDaniel has said that he was prepared to try the case based on the specific agreement that they had had. And at the bottom of page 6, he says, based upon my conversation with Mr. Hall as to how it is that he intends, and the adverb is now, to defend the case. Now, not what we've always agreed to. And this is at the 11th hour when trial is ready to begin. How he now intends to defend the case, I'm not prepared to do what it is that Mr. Hall is now asking me to do.
I know, this is not, he doesn't say that Mr. Hall is asking him to put on perjured testimony or anything like that.
But he's saying Mr. Hall wants a new defense.
And that's certainly relevant to the judge's decision. He's not continuing this trial. Everybody's had plenty of time to go ahead. But that's not the issue that we're focusing on here.
Right,
I understand your point, and I think you've argued well from the record, but you can see what I'm troubled about.
Well, I think that...
if we're going to say that where a defendant who has appointed counsel tells the judge, I have four concerns, and the judge doesn't address all of them, and the defendant says, well, I guess I have to go it alone.
Well, I still think, Your Honor, that we need to focus in on the credibility determination that the judge made.
How can he make credibility where he acknowledges he doesn't know the facts?
Because Mr. McDaniel has told him, I'm prepared to try the case. The source of the disagreement is a strategic disagreement between myself and my client. I believe I've got everything I need from the government. If you look at what appellant was saying, the only things that he stated that he needed were things that were these videotapes and the cash receipt books. But Mr. McDaniel stated that he had received full discovery. He also stated that he had received from the government additional things that he had asked for, and that he was looking to go forth with trial because he was going to receive the Jenks material that week, and he was prepared.
Even though he hadn't had time to review all these documents.
Well, as the court knows, there was still another week before the trial was even to begin, and a substantial period of time before the defense was to be presented. So whatever it was that appellant was asking him to do, there still would have been plenty of time to do that before the defense was to begin. But again, the point is that Judge Kennedy is listening to this man, he is listening to appellant very carefully, and he makes a credibility determination that I think you're doing whatever, based on the case history, he comes to the conclusion that you're doing whatever you can do to avoid going to trial, and you want to delay this, and I think that that's a credibility determination and a finding of fact that has to be respected based upon this record and the judge's familiarity with...
Where does the judge say, I think you're doing everything you need to do?
He says that at the page 18 through 19 of the transcript.
That's where he says the court cannot know.
He states, this seems to me very much like a party who does not want the trial to go forward.
The judge says on page... Was this 19?
Yes, 19.
I don't know about witnesses.
Right, but after he says that, he says his ultimate conclusion is that, to me, it seems like a party who very much wishes not to have the trial go forward.
And I understand your point. That could well be true. Mm-hmm. But suppose if the judge had asked questions, there was something else involved. I'm just trying to understand this case. I mean, I think Judge Garland's questions are going to, well, this guy was guilty as could be, so.
Actually, the questions go more to the question of whether there was anything more that could be prepared that would be relevant.
I was trying to finish my sentence, as that there was nothing for the attorney to do.
Well,
that he had rejected, his client had rejected the plea offer, and, you know, this, there were no witnesses, there was no evidence.
Well, there certainly weren't any worthy or persuasive witnesses presented at the trial, that's for certain. But the
witnesses were presented.
Yes, they were, but they were.
In addition to the defendant.
But they were utterly lacking in credibility. The government's evidence in this case was so overwhelming. And there really was no defense to, you know, the overwhelming documentary evidence. And the defendant's own testimony was, a word to describe it was preposterous and contradictory.
So would the rule be that where a defendant raises concerns and the judge does not explore all of them with defense counsel, but the judge knows that the evidence is overwhelming, that there is no duty to inquire further?
No, Your Honor, but I think we need to look at what it was that this defendant actually said. This was not a shy person. He was very articulate. He had plenty of opportunity to express himself and never hesitated in doing that. And he never really stated what evidence it was that he wanted that Mr. McDaniel didn't have, what those witnesses were. He was very unspecific except for the fact
that... So the judge, because the man is educated, the judge, he never graduated from college now. But the judge has no duty to ask him, well, what witnesses are you talking about?
Well, I think the judge has a duty to inquire, what is your source of dissatisfaction? And he did that. And he listened, and defendant explained at length. It wasn't, and the fact that it wasn't specific is was the defendant's burden to make, you know, to state what the witnesses were and what the evidence was. As the court knows, many, many trials, the defense rests without putting on any witnesses or any evidence. That's hardly unusual, and it's not a sign of lack of preparation. And the defense counsel comes back and says, I was prepared based on everything that we had agreed. So he essentially rebuts everything that the defendant had said about lack of preparation, and the judge chose to believe Mr. McDaniel and to find that appellant was not credible. And I think that the court needs to respect that decision because that was a fact finding that the trial judge was entitled to make based on his knowledge of the record and the parties.
Let me ask you a question about the closing argument of the prosecutor. And I read the brief, and you respond to one statement made, but I don't find a defense of the statement that is made on page 69 of the March 2nd transcript. And, you know, keeping in mind that this jury had the jury instructions, and the jury instructions were very involved, but they were also very clear and set out for this count or for wire fraud, you must find one, two, for mail fraud, you must find one, two, so forth. And we have to presume they listened to the judge on the law, they read the instructions when they had them. But this statement is the type of statement that a lay jury, I think, would fasten on, and that is the prosecutor is saying, now the judge is going to instruct you about this, about the law. He is going to say, and he's talking specifically about good faith, a defendant does not act in good faith if, even though he honestly holds a certain opinion or belief, that defendant also knowingly makes a false or fraudulent pretense representation, promises to others. Okay, there, you've got the false or fraudulent. But then he recaps and says, so Mr. Hall, if you, after careful consideration, come to the determination that initially he had a real dream and that he was operating in good faith, if you subsequently find that he lied to one investor one time about something that is material, we are done. I realize he's recapping what he has said before, but what concerns me is a lay jury hearing, all I have to do is find that he lied to one person at one time, and that's all I have to do.
Well, I think that the judge's instructions really cured this, and because actually the judge had a lengthy discussion with the parties about the proposed instructions and did alter them in one particular respect, and that was to include the fact that it had to be very clear that there had to be an intent to defraud, a specific intent to defraud. And I think it's important that that was included in the instructions in order to, and I think that that would have cured any misimpression that was left by the passage on page 69.
That's what I didn't find in your red brief. So was the defense in effect or explanation of why this is not a cause for concern?
Well, I think that that was the issue there is the intent to defraud, Your Honor, and I think that the fact that the jury instructions did clearly require the jury to find an intent to defraud, perhaps we could have addressed that more particularly. Okay. We did run out of space a little bit, but I think it's important to realize that the very last thing the jury heard about the law was that it was bound, the judge telling you're bound to follow the law as I explain it to you. That's the very last thing they heard, and that was well after this.
It's also important that they had these very complex instructions, 40 pages worth, with them.
They had a copy of the instructions.
And we presume that they read them, listened to the judge. Mm-hmm. All right. Judge Rogers, do you have any questions? Judge Garland?
No, thank you.
Okay. I would like to thank the court for its time and request that the judgment be affirmed, except for the fact that the sentencing issues that we've raised in our brief. Thank you.
What about that? I'm sorry, now that you've mentioned that.
Yes.
I don't understand why you would remand the Ponzi scheme damages when you agree with the defendant on what amount they should be. Why shouldn't we take what the defendant says? And I mean, they suggest there's no reason for a remand. This is quite clear.
Yes, Your Honor. We haven't challenged the calculation of the loss to losing a victim's method. We agree with that.
There will be no reason to remand that issue.
The only reason is we just thought that there are two separate figures, the 747 and then the 712. There are two different figures there. And we just simply thought that the trial judge should make a fact finding in the first instance. But
You agree that I think the level is 14 or something like that?
It actually wouldn't make any difference, I think, if it was the 747 or the 712,000.
The defendant's clearly right about this, and it's reflected in the sentencing guidelines.
Yes, we haven't challenged that calculation of loss, but the only reason we didn't agree to have this court impose it was we simply thought it was a fact-finding that the trial judge should make in the first instance.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Your Honors.
Does Ryan have any time? All right. Why don't you take a minute?
I'm sorry, I have one question for you, that I should have asked before on the erroneous instruction with respect to securities fraud.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you understand to be the difference between paren 3, close paren, which is to engage in a transaction that would operate as a fraud, when you pair that with the instruction that there has to be intent to defraud, and the first one, to employ any device, scheme, or artifice to defraud? That is, why wouldn't the Ponzi scheme be proof of both? What vulnerability is three opening your client up to that is not already opened up by number one?
Well, there may have been no Ponzi scheme.
No. If there either there was or there wasn't.
But. Right. And I'm saying that the jury could convict even if they thought there was no Ponzi scheme, but that the APA itself operated as a fraud because it was set up to make it usurious.
But that's just a different set of, that's not a problem with respect to the instruction. That's a problem with respect to, say, a factual theory about what is a fraud. I don't understand why number three makes it more likely that this APA, that the APA would come under three rather than under one, for example.
That was the government's theory of three.
Well, but in its closing, the government says there are a lot of things here that would fit under three, but I'm focusing on the APA thing. But leave aside their theory for a minute. Just do you see any difference between three? Doesn't appear to me any easier for the government to prove than one.
It doesn't require a scheme. I mean, I don't think Congress would have made it a separate thing if they didn't think it was somehow different.
Well, that's a different question, what Congress meant. The case law that I've been able to find on this suggests that, if anything, three is harder normally because it requires you to prove an impact on the investor, which is not required in one. In a civil case, three is easier to prove because it doesn't require intent to defraud, but that is, it can be done by negligence. But that's not the case here where there was the instruction. I don't see how three changes your client's vulnerability, that's all.
I think the word scheme is a really hard thing to prove. I confess I haven't done the research Your Honor is referring to, so I'm not familiar with anything suggesting three is harder. My just reading it, it seemed easier because it doesn't require a scheme.
Well, number one doesn't require a scheme. It can require a device or an artifice.
Well,
so
that's even more.
Well, I don't know what that means.
Yeah, well, exactly. And I think the juries struggle with those things. Those concepts are very hard to pin down, and they're hard for juries to find. If I could just quickly, going to Judge Kennedy's opinion about Mr. McDaniel, it cannot be enough alone, and because what matters is really what the defendant thinks. And, you know, I think that in a normal case where it's just a continuance or a substitute counsel motion and the defendant goes on with counsel, I think it's probably fine for the judge to go on his gut instinct because he knows that Edward Bennett Williams is going to do a good job, and that's all that's going to matter at the end of the day. But when it becomes clear the defendant is so convinced that this guy is not going to be of no use to him, that he's actually better off with himself, then the judge has to get serious and has to do more than satisfy himself, has to satisfy Mr. Hall.
I'm quite sympathetic to the line of questioning that Judge Rogers was raising. But what I'm concerned about is the risk that this can taint the judge. That is, if you go too far along this line, and would that not be a concern to defense counsel? You're up before the judge. That judge is going to do the sentencing in the end. The defense counsel is asked, are you prepared? He says, I am. If the judge starts saying, well, why aren't you going to put on these witnesses? Mm-hmm. The defense counsel says, because they can't testify that there wasn't, that they weren't paid, for example, the witnesses who were the investors can't testify that they weren't paid out of another investor's amount of money. Or he says, basically, my client has no case, and I think it's better to put the government's to its proof, and I think the best thing here is to not have him testify or them testify, and to just say the government, like you say, that this was an ambiguous prospectus, the government has a burden of proof. I mean, as a defense lawyer, I've seen many times I saw that happen, and as a prosecutor, many times I saw that happen,
right,
that somebody might
defendant for them to say that explicitly to the judge. The judge sees that's what's going on in the trial. I mean, it's not like any secrets are any prejudicial. And the defendant is the one that wants the judge to investigate. So, I mean, he's essentially accusing the lawyer of not doing his job, so that's waiving,
Is that waiving attorney-client privilege?
Well, certainly on the issues of whether he's done the things, if they have a factual dispute between themselves.
So you don't see any problem with a long, and I would use the word intrusive, because I think the more intrusive, obviously, the better from one point of view, inquiry as to the nature of the defendant's case in front of the judge who's going to sentence him?
No. I mean, as long as the government's not there, I don't.
Uh-huh.
Because it's the defendant who's choosing to have these things raised and inquired into, so I think that's his choice. And I just want to emphasize again, the attorney never says he doesn't agree that the things the client wants done don't need to be done. And on the issue of the overwhelmingness, I don't see how that goes to this argument at all. If anything, it could go to the other closing argument, yes. But I can't believe, I mean, the defendant did call witnesses. You were saying, what could he have done? He did call witnesses. And I just can't believe the defense counsel can decide a case is so, meritless and overwhelming that there's no point in preparing.
No, I wanted to be clear. That was not at all what I was suggesting. What I was suggesting is that he had no more evidence to put on, that he would be better off, given the overwhelming nature of the case against him, to rest on the burden,
right,
which is a classic,
yes,
strategy of defense counsel.
Right.
That's what I'm saying.
Right, and that may have been a fine thing to do, but I think Mr. Hall's complaint is he hasn't investigated, he hasn't gone and looked at the stuff, and we don't know specifically what witnesses whether were being raised or whatever.
Is there an allegation that In his request for Brady material, the government said, we have Brady material, but it's in this box in Maryland, and you have to come and get it? That's not the suggestion. The suggestion is the government gave him everything they thought was Brady
material. Made everything accessible, yes. And Mr. Hall was just complaining that he had told Mr. McDaniel, look, there's these cash receipt books. You need to get copies of those. Those are going to be exculpatory because they eliminate my motive, because it's going to show I did not spend this money. It's not, Ponzi scheme is designed to, like, create money for a defendant to, you know, steal. And it's going to show that, in fact, the money all went into the business, or just a very small amount maybe did not. And so that really decimates the government's motive. You need to go get those books. I don't think he was complaining about McDaniel's sort of, you know, failure to take action on things that he.
All right. Thank you.
Okay.
I'm taking up time. Thank you. Call the next case.